This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marbo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
For the past 19 months, Lebanon has been reeling from a wrenching economic crisis. By the time the crisis erupted in October in 2019, the economy was facing four extraordinary challenges: elevated public sector debt, a bankrupt banking sector, no economic growth, and the country was politically rudderless. Predicting how the crisis evolves from here is difficult. Lebanon's economic crisis, a tragedy in the making, in this following report. Lebanon's annual inflation rate reached a record high, and food prices soared by around 500% in February, highlighting the dramatic impact on consumers and businesses of the country's worst financial crisis in decades. With hindsight, Lebanon's economic crisis was predictable. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was already facing four extraordinary challenges. First, public sector debt had reached such elevated levels that a default had become a question of when, not if. Second, the banking sector, having lent three-quarters of deposits to the government, had become functionally bankrupt and increasingly illiquid. Third, the productive economy had experienced virtually no growth for an entire decade, a development with acute socio-political implications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the country was politically aimless. There was no president between 2014 and 2016. There were multiple and lengthy delays in cabinet formation, and the 2018 parliamentary elections took place, but only after a five-year delay. The Hariri government that was in place when the crisis hit in 2019 became impotent to such an extent that it lacked power to deliver on any of the reforms required as a condition for foreign support. By October 2019, the citizenry had had enough. Sensing a looming crisis and frustrated by the utter lack of action by the political class, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets demanding radical political change. The cabinet resigned, throwing the country into a political crisis. Unsurprisingly, capital inflows came to a sudden halt. Banks, already insolvent, experienced a sharp liquidity crunch, forcing them to declare a bank holiday and institute severe restrictions on bank withdrawals. A foreign exchange black market emerged, and the national currency, the lira, sharply depreciated. In return, inflation soared and people's real wages and purchasing power collapsed. In addition, as if all these woes aren't enough, a severe COVID-19 crisis hit the country, and most tragically, a devastating explosion took place on August 4, 2020, leveling a third of downtown Beirut. Human capital is fast eroding due to a massive brain drain of the young and skilled. Equally worrying is the loss of physical productive capacity resulting from widespread business closures. Much more alarming are the security consequences of the economic implosion. Lebanon's sectarian history is rife with conflict, and economic collapse provides a perfect habitat for a return of violence. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Nasri Harb, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Yuzal University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nasri Harb. Now, left to its own devices, the Lebanese economy will for sure generate an alarming acceleration of youth and skilled labor immigration. We have a lot of enterprises closing. The currency is becoming further unanchored. Hyperinflation is wiping the incomes of the public and their wealth. And we have now food and medical shortages that seem will only escalate, which requires more level of humanitarian support, foreign humanitarian support. That is the worst case scenario, and I thought that we were already there. Could this become even worse now?
Okay, hi Marwa. I think there is no limit to how bad we can go. Let me tell you this. As long as the government does not take any action, things will worsen. The hyperinflation will fuel itself. As a number, we can cite two recent examples from two economies. In Venezuela, for instance, where inflation has reached about 65,000%.
Wow.
That is a 71% inflation every month, which means that your salary that you receive at the beginning of the month will lose 70% of its value at the end of the month. So you are left with only 30%. Another typical example is, a famous example is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, in the peak of the hyperinflation, currency used to lose 98%, which is almost its whole value every day at the peak of the inflation. So there is no limit to how bad we can go.
That is a scary thought right there.
Indeed.
But there is one best case scenario for Lebanon that's being discussed all around now, is by starting with a cabinet. That should be giving some sort of a short-term stabilization program for the country, which involves tightening of liquidity, maybe arresting the fiscal implosion, maybe inducing capital control, especially on large amounts of money which are still being leaked out of the country, and maybe obtaining an urgent external bridge loan like that of the IMF. However, look, I understand all these points that we are speaking about, but wouldn't even more loans by the Lebanese be a burden for them rather than an actual escape from this reality?
The loan from the IMF, you can say it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from one side, it will call for more reform, it will help, and it will ask for discipline from the government. However, on the other hand, if there is no discipline, if the loan is not well negotiated, because the trend at the IMF is to follow more liberal action, reducing government size, and taking harsh action towards the harsh social action. So if it's not well negotiated, it may lead to further social problems.
You mean more privatization instead of putting help towards the public institutions?
Exactly. So it takes strong political action and strong political negotiation to negotiate a good terms for these loans. That's one. Two. If this loan is not well used, it will add to the burden of the country, like the debt to the country, like similar to what happened to Paris conferences. We have received aids and billions of dollars, and after all, it came out like as a burden on the country.
And our debt becomes $120 billion.
Exactly.
But the annual inflation rate, Dr. Harbi, is that it reached a high record, and the food prices soared. There are more than 500% this February 2021, highlighting the dramatic impact on both consumers and enterprises as well, especially because this is the worst economic crisis for at least two decades. How much longer do you think these businesses can withstand such a dramatic impact on them?
It's difficult to say, but however, the conditions are very harsh. If we can cite what are the problems faced by the businesses, it's unbelievable. You have one, reduced demand. People are poorer than before. Difficult investment because there is no exchange. Unstable exchange rate. You can start with a given price, and then at the end of the day, the price will be changed. Uncertainty. Okay, you can never tell what to expect in the next day. Unmotivated employees, which will reduce the cost of production.
Mm-hmm.
You have also angry consumer, which will be very difficult to deal with. You have difficult financial transaction. If you want to export, if you want to import, how can I afford the exchange rate? Okay, cost of changing price is by itself. Cost of changing price is huge.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, in some supermarket, like during, I think, German hyperinflation, 50% of the employees' time was on only changing prices. So
it's very costly for the
exactly.
enterprise.
So just changing prices takes 50% of your resources.
And the remaining 50% is now becoming a referee, trying to stop people from killing one another. What are you saying represents a public call, Dr. Nasri, to all Lebanese decision makers, whether it is the prime minister, designated one, the central bank governor, even the president of the republic as well? I personally do not see a glimmer of hope here. I'm a realist. But as an economist, what would be the first thing that you would do to try and salvage what is left of the economy in this country?
Okay. Well, we were speaking about that in a conference a few days ago. Mm-hmm. What it takes at the beginning, first of all, like a political will. Okay. Once we have a political will, any action can help. It takes a multilateral plan. You have, first of all, of course, you have to have a sort of capital control. You have to and that's very important, to establish trust. So I would say trust, then trust, then trust. That's the first point. Capital control, restoration of banking sector, okay? And we can speak also about halting the money printing process, because this is the main cause of the inflation. Economical reforms and structural reforms. I can speak here about political reform and economical reform. Especially, like, we can give an example, a simple example, which will be a good start, is to rebuild the electrical system for electrical sector. Rebuild it, okay. And an important one is to encourage import substituting industries, mm-hmm. because this is one of the main source of fleeing the currency.
You see, this is what we lack in Lebanon, Dr. Nasri. We should have someone like you to be Minister of Economy, and yet we are still fighting between one another which sect will get which ministry, which, by the way, puts me at a very depressed position as a Lebanese citizen, because I don't know whether tomorrow will be better or even 10 times worse. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri Harab, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Izal University. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
COVID-19 has brutally exposed and deepened inequality both within and between countries and highlighted the staggering disregard for shared humanity, says Brett Wilkins, writer, in an article published under the heading Amnesty International's Annual Global Human Rights Report Details Harm and Heroism Amid Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Offering an incisive overview of the world in this era and focusing largely on how governments have responded or failed to respond to the coronavirus pandemic, Amnesty International recently released its annual Global Human Rights Report. Amnesty International Report 2020, 21st, The State of the World's Human Rights, examines human rights in 149 countries, highlighting how people who were already among the world's most marginalized, including refugees, women, racial and religious minorities, and the poor, suffered the brunt of the impact of COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 and its mass casualties flourished in part thanks to global milieu of deeper, broader inequalities within and between countries, the report asserts. It has been made far worse by austerity policies that weakened public infrastructure and public health systems, by international architecture, enfeebled in form, function, and leadership. And it has been made far worse under pressure from leaders of states who demonize and exclude, asserting archaic constructs of state sovereignty and peddling rejectionist approaches to science, evidence, and universal norms. The report takes aim at wealthy countries accused of stockpiling coronavirus vaccine doses while depriving less developed nations of the life-saving medications, a practice that many observers have called vaccine apartheid. While the World Health Organization's COVAX facility represented a positive global initiative aimed at ensuring more countries could access vaccines, it was undermined by the non-participation of the USA, the hoarding of vaccines by rich countries, and the failure of companies to share their intellectual property, it states. More than 90 countries introduced export restrictions affecting items including medical equipment, PPE, personal protective equipment, pharmaceutical products, and food. Wealthy states also blocked adoption of a proposal at the World Trade Organization for a temporary waiver of intellectual property rights for COVID-19 products that was designed to facilitate universal access, the report continues. The report details how the pandemic has exacerbated the already precarious existence of people, including refugees, migrants, and asylum seekers, as well as women and workers in informal economy. It also notes that authoritarian regimes around the world have used the pandemic as a pretext to repress human rights. Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Callamard said in a statement that COVID-19 has brutally exposed and deepened inequality both within and between countries, and highlighted the staggering disregard that statesmen have for shared humanity. Decades of divisive policies, misguided austerity measures, and choices by statesmen not to invest in crumbling public infrastructure have left too many easy prey to this virus. We are reaping the results of years of calculated neglect at the hands of the statesman, Callimore added. In 2020, under the unique strain of a pandemic, health systems have been put to the ultimate test and people have been left in financial freefall, while those who gave the most were protected the least. The report isn't all gloom and doom. It hails the exceptional leadership that came not from power, privilege, or profits, but rather from nurses, doctors, and health workers on the front line of life-saving services. The report adds that leadership also came from those who cared for older people and from technicians and scientists running millions of tests and trials, frantically searching for vaccines. It came from those who bunched together more often at every bottom of the income scale, worked to feed the rest of us, who cleared our streets, cared for the bodies of the hundreds of thousands of diseased, repaired our essential services, patrolled our streets, drew what remained of our public transport, it states. It adds, in 2020, as so much of the world shut down, it was those people who stood up, who stood out. So to those who stayed home in solidarity, if they had a home to live in, who maintained emotionally costly physical distance, and who cared for those around them.
Around the World with Reporters.
World Health Day is celebrated on the 7th of April every year. For 2021, the theme is Building a Fair, Healthier World. For Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, health inequities are an everyday reality that is rooted in Israel's long-held apartheid regime. Tel Aviv has waged three wars on the blockaded enclave and maintains a crippling blockade on it since 2007. During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces attacked 17 hospitals and 56 health centers. The Israeli regime's inhumane practices have led to a state of de-development within Gaza's healthcare system, making it extremely hard for health workers to combat the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place over the past 14 years has battered the entire health system in the Gaza Strip. Hospitals and medical centers suffer from acute shortages in medicines and medical equipment, especially amid the rapid spread of the coronavirus pandemic.
This year's World Health Day comes amid a surge in coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip. Despite the increasing number of coronavirus infections in the impoverished enclave, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment.
On this day, we confirmed that the epidemiological situation in the Gaza Strip is very dangerous, and the curve of infections continues to increase. Everyone must take the necessary measures to safeguard their families. We also call on all concerned local and international parties to help us in fighting the pandemic.
Under international laws and norms, the Israeli regime must ensure medical supplies to Palestinians, including combating the spread of pandemics. Experts warn that the health sector in Gaza could soon collapse unless serious steps are made to remedy the situation.
On World Health Day, the regime's blockade continues to undermine efforts by health workers in Gaza to provide proper medical care. This is while the situation has worsened in the besieged enclave due to the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Around 45% of Italian firms involved in productive sectors are structurally at risk. This is one of the major findings of a new report on the competitiveness of productive sectors in Italy, released by the Bureau of Statistics Istat on Wednesday. The report warns that firms operating mostly in sectors of low technological and knowledge content would not be able to survive to a further external crisis.
The situation wasn't very much different before the COVID crisis. Italian firms were already suffering from their usual weaknesses. If these firms don't receive financial aid in the coming 3 to 4 months, they will drown. Non-food activities are suffering the most.
A series of national lockdowns to safeguard Italy's population from COVID-19 and the collapse of the health system have resulted in an economic disaster. According to the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, about 390,000 businesses shut their doors in Italy last year.
The Istat report has found tourism, arts and entertainment and catering are among the productive sectors that have suffered with great intensity from the impact of the containment measures adopted by the Italian authorities so far.
Take out food and delivery orders won't save my restaurant. That's all we've been allowed to do for months. Either we reopen in full or we die. We've got bills to pay.
I'm not surprised people have not yet taken to the streets to stage a revolution. I'm lucky to have my pension payments. Many, including my son, are jobless. Many went bankrupt.
Meanwhile, Italy has been swept by protests from north to south over the past days. Hospitality operators, restaurant owners, shopkeepers, street market traders are calling for reopenings as a second round of government economic support measures has been delayed. Max Civili, Rome.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a have marched on the United Nations office in the city to slam the international community's silence in the face of Saudi's illegal acts. The protesters called for international action amid the continued detention of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition.
Today we have completed 2 years of protests in front of the United Nations office. We organized 730 protests to denounce the continued piracy against fuel ships. We have a 1,400-meter-long letter of condemnation signed by the Yemenis. The United Nations and the U.S. are directly observing the detention of oil vessels, and they bear responsibility for the humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
The protesters slammed the U.S. as a key partner in exacerbating the suffering of millions of Yemenis. They said Saudi Arabia's U.S.-backed siege on Yemen has caused a severe shortage of basics, including fuel, food and water, leading to numerous deaths, including among children.
Public sector employees are protesting today in front of the United Nations office because the UN bears the moral and humanitarian responsibility regarding the continued detention of oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition as it happens under the direct supervision of the UN.
Since the beginning of 2015, Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade in Yemen, depriving millions of civilians of their necessities and even hampering the humanitarian aid in the war-torn country. This has pushed the country to the brink of famine and has wrecked the healthcare system.
For 2 years now, Yemenis have been protesting outside the United Nations office in Sana'a with no tangible results. However, they say their army is now capable of forcing Saudi Arabia into listening to their voices and lift the blockade it imposed on their country. Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining participants of the nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. The sides have set up 2 expert-level working groups that are going to come up with 2 lists, one of sanctions to be lifted by the United States and the other of nuclear measures to be undertaken by Iran in order for the country to return to full compliance with the nuclear agreement. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says Tehran is not interested in any step-by-step return to the deal and is demanding the full removal of sanctions imposed, reimposed or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA.
I have come here to do business, but I doubt that there is the same seriousness in the other side. If the U.S. is serious, they should be prepared to lift all sanctions that they have imposed or reimposed against Iran. And after verification, we certainly go back to full compliance.
Iran says it has not and will not engage in any direct or indirect talks with the U.S., and it would be up to the other JCPOA signatories, namely Britain, France, Germany, China, and Russia, to talk to the Americans. The Joint Commission will meet again in Vienna on Friday to review the work of the expert groups and discuss sequence and timing. But if there's a lack of progress, Tehran says, it will end the talks. We are not in a hurry, says Iran's lead delegate. Homolezki, Vienna.
This racist, Islamophobic, misogynistic.
The daughter of a Muslim who was murdered by a white supremacist as he walked home from his local mosque has launched a campaign demanding the UK government finally adopt an Islamophobia definition. Maz Salim, whose father, Mohammed Salim, was killed by a neo-Nazi terrorist 8 years ago, has launched the campaign to highlight Islamophobic hate crimes and force the definition back on the government's agenda.
Pablo Lapchin was charged under terrorism laws. It's been 8 years now. I've been tirelessly campaigning against racism and Islamophobia. And still today, my father's name is not being mentioned in the mainstream media as an act of terrorism. And I think that's really important because whenever a Muslim is a victim, the media is very biased in the way it reports it. It's always such as lone wolf or mosque bomber or murderer. No, he was actually, quite frankly, a terrorist. So I want that to be highlighted. That's extremely important.
The campaign includes an online hashtag, I am Mohammed Salim, which others can use to post testimonies exposing how dangerous Islamophobia is becoming.
I've already been inundated with a lot of videos, a lot of footage, which I'm going to release every single day. And if you already look on our Twitter and our Instagram, you can see already people speaking about their experience of racism, Islamophobia and xenophobia. So if you continue to send us these videos, then we can put pressure on the government as to what is exactly happening on our streets today.
Sadly, Mohammed Salim is not the only victim. In 2015, 81-year-old Mohsin Ahmed was killed by two men in a racially motivated attack in Rotherham. And in 2017, Makram Ali was killed during the Finsbury Park terror attack during the holy month of Ramadan. In 2018, an all-party parliamentary group issued a report on anti-Muslim prejudice, which urged the government to define Islamophobia. So far, the government has refused to do so.
Islamophobic attacks and racist verbal abuse are becoming near normalised here in Britain, with many Muslims complaining that it's become basically a daily occurrence. But if the government continues to refuse to acknowledge that Islamophobia is a very real and vicious form of hate crime, then preventing future attacks and also providing justice to victims will continue to get all the more harder. Robert Carter, London.
Palestinian children continue to suffer due to Israel's inhumane practices as they mark Palestinian Child Day. Israeli forces have killed and injured thousands of Palestinian children over the past decade under the watchful eye of the international community. Last year alone, Israeli forces killed 9 Palestinian children. During a press conference marking the annual event, Palestinians demanded that Israeli forces be held accountable for their crimes against Palestinian children.
Israeli soldiers are acting with impunity because they feel that they will not be prosecuted for their crimes. Such policies have encouraged Israeli soldiers to violate our rights. The international community must take concrete steps to prosecute those Israeli soldiers who kill and maim us on a daily basis.
Scores of Palestinian children lost their lives during the Great March of Return peaceful rallies due to Israel's use of excessive force against peaceful protesters. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinian children were systematic.
As we mark Palestinian Child Day, Israel continues to commit grave violations against Palestinian children, including wounding them and killing them. Israel also violates the social, economic, and cultural rights. The Israeli blockade has negatively affected all aspects of life for Palestinian children in the Gaza Strip.
Since 2008, the Israeli regime waged three wars on the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming thousands of children. During Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including hundreds of children.
The Zionist enemy violates the rights of Palestinian children to live. They have bombed the homes where Palestinian children live and have deprived them from receiving proper education and health care. Palestinian children are even deprived from the right of movement.
Palestinian Child Day highlights the ongoing plight of those born under Israeli occupation and blockade.
Human rights groups have long accused the Israeli regime of deliberately targeting Palestinian children. This comes amid the failure of the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Going without food may seem extreme to some, but for many Yemenis, it's a part of daily life. After Saudi Arabia began its war on Yemen in 2015, it quickly moved to encircle the nation, and huge swaths of the country have been facing chronic malnutrition ever since. Now, supporters abroad are refusing food as well, in an effort to draw attention to Yemenis' desperate plight.
We're here outside the White House, where activists with the Yemeni Liberation Movement have gathered to call for an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led siege on Yemen. Many of them have decided to put their bodies on the line and are now on day six of an ongoing hunger strike in solidarity with the Yemeni people starving under the blockade.
We're here at Washington, D.C. We came all the way from Michigan, and we're in Washington, D.C. to demand an end for the U.S. for the U.S.'s support on the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen, which is causing the biggest humanitarian crisis in the last 100 years. Over 22 million people are experiencing starvation, and every 75 seconds a child dies from starvation.
For the millions deprived of basic supplies like medicine and fuel, every day is a struggle for survival. According to UNICEF, over two-thirds of Yemen's population, or more than 20 million people, are in need of humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, activists say the U.S. government has been working continuously to enable the Saudi aggression.
So the United States is not only complicit in this genocide, they are wholeheartedly and completely supporting it at every possible aspect, militarily, with intelligence and logistics. They have provided billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in weapon sales to the Saudi government, as well as helping the Saudi government enforce the fuel blockade, which is currently enforced since December 2020.
It's been nearly a week since they've eaten, and going without food is starting to take a toll. But these activists are determined to carry on, saying the situation in Yemen has gotten so bad that they simply have no other choice.
Because it gets pretty foggy and hazy. And I think we're also realizing this is only a fraction of what Yemeni people are having to deal with. So we want folks at home to really understand that.
And I just want to add, you know, so many folks say, like, why are y'all starving yourselves? You know, like, you should be doing something else. And really, it's a last resort. If you look at hunger strikes from, you know, the Irish hunger strike or prison hunger strikes, these are people whose power was taken away, and this is a last resort.
Wyatt Reed, Washington.
After a lull of around 20 months, street protests against Indian rule resurfaced in Indian-controlled Kashmir. That came after three suspected anti-India fighters were killed by government forces in an anti-militancy operation on Friday in the southern district of Pulwama. Officials say two of the three men were involved in killing a policeman guarding a local politician's house. Like in past, hundreds of people marched towards the site of the gun battle in support of the fighters. They chanted slogans against the Indian rule in the region. Government forces used tear gas and fired shotgun pellets at the stone-throwing protesters, injuring 4 people. India imposed a security crackdown on Kashmir after August 5, 2019, when it unilaterally stripped the region of its autonomy. The crackdown, coupled with the COVID-19 lockdown, kept people from taking to streets. Indian officials called the Kashmir unrest, quote, Pakistan-sponsored terrorism, a charge that Islamabad denies.
Pakistan. Through social media, Pakistan is instigating, encouraging and radicalizing the youth of Kashmir to join terrorist outfits. The youth are fearless and innocent. They don't know what they are doing. Whoever chooses this path should remember the outcome is either jail or death.
A senior journalist and political analyst from Kashmir says there is pent-up anger among people and this is going to be critical this summer.
A series of laws that have come, including other things which are happening at such a galloping pace. So now people are really trying to express their anger, through one way or the other. You saw the protests in Jamia Masjid, the clashes there. You saw, government degree college in 2 South Kashmir districts. So I think this summer is going to be very tricky.
Last month, India and Pakistan agreed to abide by their 2003 ceasefire agreement along the de facto borders dividing Kashmir. However, the crackdown by security forces and attacks by militants continue unabated. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan since their independence from the British rule in 1947. The two countries have fought wars over the region and claim sovereignty over it. After witnessing decades of violence, people in Kashmir aim to see a peaceful future. Majority of people living here believe global powers need to play their part before the animosity between India and Pakistan claims more lives here. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The US and Iran will go back to the negotiating table in Vienna to talk about the nuclear deal. The U.S. State Department made this bombshell announcement on Friday, and it's now the talk of the town. But a high-ranking source in Iran says that Tehran has no such a plan before Washington lifts all sanctions against Iran. Since Biden took office, Iran has made it clear that it is the U.S. that should return to the nuclear deal first, as it was the one that unilaterally and illegally withdrew from the agreement. This stance is shared by Iranian lawmakers as well.
Our leader has put the final word on it. No talks with the U.S. until all sanctions are lifted. After Iran made sure that all of the illegal sanctions are no longer in place, then we would return to our commitments.
There is no point in negotiating to the U.S. while it was the one that broke the international rules and withdrew from the accord. We retaliated by scaling back some of our obligations to the deal, and that's based on Article 35 and 36 of the JCPOA. We have not violated anything.
Senior officials from all signatories to the nuclear deal, namely Iran, France, Germany, the UK, Russia and China, will gather in the Austrian capital on Tuesday to discuss ways to salvage the ailing accord. The Biden administration is also sending a team of experts to Vienna. Washington hopes to talk to the Iranian representatives over a step-by-step timetable that would bring both sides to compliance with the accord.
And the primary issues that will be discussed are the nuclear steps that Iran would need to take in order to return to compliance with the JCPOA.
There's no step-by-step plan, says Tehran. Iranian officials say the aim of the Vienna session would be to rapidly finalize the removal of all sanctions and nothing else.
Iran will not accept any step-by-step proposal. We think that there will be just one step, lifting all the sanctions. After the verification, Iran will come back to its commitment.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran responded by ramping up its enrichment of uranium and limiting international monitoring of its nuclear sites. Meanwhile, Biden has indicated that he's willing to clean up his predecessor's mess, but has taken no practical steps to do so. Observers say any headway should be made before Iran's presidential elections in June, which could lead to the formation of a new Iranian negotiating team and more delays.
So the bottom line is, there will be no direct or indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. in Vienna or anywhere else. Iran says any return by the U.S. to the nuclear deal will not need any negotiations. Once it's in the deal, Iran will reverse all its remedial steps and will go back to full compliance. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz.
In the beginning of the spread of the coronavirus, we did not even have masks. Our youth and our people produced masks and disinfectants at home and at mosque. It was really a manifestation of cutting the dependence on foreign countries. And we continued to move forward until we faced the challenge to produce a vaccine. Today, vaccines are thankfully being tested and produced in several ways. This is a source of reputation for the country. Fair-minded foreign analysts are praising our country for this. This path was tested by the Iranian nation and they will continue it by Allah's favor.
Turning threats into opportunities by relying on domestic forces.
Thousands of youth in knowledge-based companies and production centers are busy manufacturing products under foreign sanctions, and these products both have better quality and, as I said earlier, are cheaper. The same is true of other fields of knowledge. No matter how much we speak about the talents of our youth, it is really not enough.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever wanna need. my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In the area of new sciences such as nanotechnology, we are among the top countries in the world. As for scientific articles, according to scientific databases in the world, in the course of the past 20 years, this is because nanotechnology is a new science, Iran wrote, for example, 10 articles in the area of nano. But in 2020, it produced 12,000 articles. In other words, in the space of 20 years, we improve from 10 articles to 12,000. Such tasks are thankfully being carried out in the country. These are important achievements. As for military areas, the country's progress is thankfully becoming more and more noticeable, brilliant, and in the eyes of some people, astonishing, because these military products increase the country's foreign security. This is very important for the country. Now the army is, by the will of Allah, the fortress of the subjects. The military forces are in fact a fortress for the security of the country. Therefore, the threat of sanctions, which is a real threat and a crime in the true sense of the word, could be turned into an opportunity if we rely on our domestic capacities and forces.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praise. Praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to
Today. Yet another strategic partnership was signed by China as an extension of its Belt and Road Initiative to revive the old Silk Road. This time, the CSP, Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, was signed between the East Asian power and West Asian heavyweight Iran. Saturday, March the 27th, was the day the landmark agreement may have reset the course of history. How Iranians have reacted and what it will mean for this country is our major concern this day. A 25-year agreement with an upcoming superpower. It's only natural for it to provoke fear of the unknown in many. But really, it's not that far-fetched looking at the world's latest equations and how the JCPOA went for Iran. Why wouldn't this country commit to a new comprehensive agreement with an Eastern power when the West failed to share commitment to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. The The United States and Europe and Israel are not happy about the Asian alliance. That in itself should put any concerned Iranians at ease. If they are not happy about it, it's probably good for Iran and China. Mr. Vafai is the Tehran University Chinese Studies chief. He predicts the future in the context of the past.
Well, for a country like Iran, which is facing Western sanctions and has plans for its future, for example, with regards to production, which the leader of the Islamic Revolution has emphasized, strengthening ties with the world's second largest economy in the long run can prove valuable and create many opportunities. So this agreement is definitely in Iran's interest.
Mr. Khorramshah chairs the Foreign Relations Strategic Council. I asked him for an insight into the deal.
On the one hand, we have Europe and the United States, which signed a deal with us after many years, the JCPOA, saying that we'll give you benefits in exchange for concessions. We had to give them what they said, and they acknowledged that we offered them all at once. So what did they offer in return? Almost nothing. This is what the head of our central bank has said in public. Nothing. They kept us waiting for a long time, and then Mr. Trump came along and announced the end of the deal altogether. On the other hand, our other powers such as China and Russia, they did not boycott our oil, they did not block us financially, they did not constantly badger us on human rights issues, they did not pressure us on regional issues, instructing us where to be and what to say. They didn't tell us what the range, fuel, shape and size of our missiles had to be, and so on. If a wise person was to choose between these two blocks of powers, which one would he go for?
The alliance would mean economic, political and security cooperation between two countries celebrating 50 years of modern diplomatic ties and over 2,000 years of shared history. Rather than money, Iran would be paying in oil for construction of its critical ports and shores, and the cooperation would grant both countries a more convenient transit route connecting both their open waters. That I will have justified by a guest on the show.
Anyway, Iran's Chabahar port has an enormous capacity as it's located on China's Silk Road by the sea. However, China has a strategic rivalry with India. Their relations are fragile on some issues, and this will certainly affect Iran-China relations in this area. Meanwhile, there's Pakistan, which has good relations with both Iran and China. I think Pakistan can play a constructive role in this area. The Islamic Republic of Iran should strike a balance in its ties with Pakistan, China, and India to define a maritime identity along the Chinese Silk Road.
It's like it came to the West as an electric shock. This Sino-Iranian memorandum is another sign of maximum pressure sanctions failure. The U.S. has been mulling how to return to the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal without lifting sanctions off Iran. While 2 months since Joe Biden took office as U.S. president may not seem long, it was long enough for Iran to consider other prospective partners. That's the thing with love. Put it off, and it doesn't take long to get late. It may appear to be a task for the government, but with any national, international agreement as major as the one we are studying today, the approval of Parliament is of paramount importance. So we are here in Majlis to talk to an MP. Our MP of the day is Mr. Amouyi of the National Security Committee.
In the Parliament, we are pursuing this topic with precision. The Parliament's first working day in the new year was actually centered on this issue. The question is if the Parliament should be involved in the ratification of this agreement. From a legal point of view, this agreement is not binding. As a result, it is not applied to the Article 77 of the Constitution, which says all the agreements should be passed in the Parliament. Beyond that, however, the Parliament has its own supervisory obligations and has held sessions with the Deputy Foreign Minister in order to construe this document accurately and assess its benefits and possible flaws.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei said this country never trusted the West, as China and Iran agreed to increase bilateral trade more than tenfold to $600 billion in the next decade. To the greater alarm of the West, the hint of an Eastern axis emerging is a reality. While China depends on Iran for its energy imports, Russia needs Iran in terms of its new security architecture vision for the Middle East. This does not mean Iran, Russia, and China would not at this point welcome the revival of the JCPOA, because that would mean sanctions waivers and easier trade among themselves.
China shouldn't be the only country with which we are signing such documents. We must define the same long-term cooperation with our neighboring countries. We should sign similar documents with other powerful countries in the Eurasian region, such as Russia and other emerging economic countries in Asia.
Interestingly, news of the Sino-Iranian plan surfaced in 2016 when the JCPOA became operational. The JCPOA or nuclear deal was struck between Iran and the P5 plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia,